There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to The Grill. This is the place to come. This is the place to stay tuned to if you love your sport. We're covering all bases between now and 6 o'clock. We've been discussing the PGA Championship in golf. Brooks Koepka on his way to a dominating victory in that, the second major of the year. We've been talking a little football as well. Plenty more on that front to come. We're going to be building up to the Emirates FA Cup final at Wembley. We're going to be hearing from Pep Guardiola, from Javi Gracia, and we're going to be talking a lot more football between now and six. Tennis? Well, there's live tennis action. It's the women's semi-finals at the Italian Open, and in less than half an hour, Stefanos Tsitsipas, the young Greek prodigy, will be taking on Rafa Nadal for the second time in as many weeks. He's already got one victory over the great clay court maestro. Can he get another? We'll be keeping an eye on that one for you as well. We'll be talking NBA playoffs. We'll be talking a little bit of boxing. It is Dominic Brazil taking on the bronze bomber Deontay Wilder in the small hours of tomorrow morning. I know Danny Norton will have plenty to say on that. And loads more sport besides that. Cricket as well. Building up to the ICC Cricket World Cup. We'll be looking back on England's victory in their ODI series over Pakistan as well. Let's start, Danny Norton, in a bumper hour, second hour of the show, with checking in on the tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you say that Rafael Nadal and Tsitsipas should be on court in about half an hour. I think it could be a little bit longer than that, because this semi-final in the ladies' draw between Kiki Bertens and Joanna Konta could be going all the way, and they could be on court for a while, yeah, because every single game seems to be going to juice at the moment. It is 3-3 in this second set. It is 30-30 as well. Kiki Bertens serving at the moment. She took the first set by 7-5. That one went pretty much all the way down to the very end as well. Not quite to a tiebreaker. She edged out a break towards the end of that set there anyway, but it has been literally just basically inseparable, these two players have been so far. Like I say, almost every game going to juice, which is why, I mean, it feels like just a few moments ago that I was telling you that it was 1-1, when really that was about half an hour ago, which kind of shows the slow pace that we've had for this game as well. We did have actually a bit of a lull in play before as well, because a fan was unfortunately taken ill. But back on play now anyway, like I say, 3-3 in this second set with Kiki Bertens serving.
I want to play out a little clip from Nick Kyrgios. He made it on a podcast earlier this week. It has set the tennis world ablaze. A lot of people talking about this. His thoughts on the likes of Novak Djokovic, on the likes of Rafael Nadal. I want to get your reactions to that. Before we do that, though, let's talk a bit of basketball. It is the conference final. It is the Eastern and Western Conference Finals. Golden State Warriors trying to win a fourth in 5 years, taking on the Portland Trail Blazers. And over in the East, it is the Milwaukee Bucks taking on the Toronto Raptors after Kawhi Leonard's just incredible buzzer beater in the previous round. Where are things at right now, Mark Archer? I'm looking at the scoreboard and I'm seeing two dominant performances from two certain teams.
Well, I think both the Eastern Conference Finals and the Western Conference Finals have played two matches. First two matches are at home to the top seeds. So it's a best of seven match series. Both two games have been at home, have been won by the home team, which is telling. Now that both the series go back to the opposition team for the next two matches. So let's just start with the Eastern Conference Finals. Early hours of this morning in Milwaukee, it was the Bucks who took a 2-0 lead in that best of seven series. They won game two by a big margin, 22 points against the Raptors, 125-103. Led, of course, by the Greek freak Giannis, 30 points, 17 rebounds. He is the dominant player. Despite how good Kawhi Leonard's been, and that shot, that buzzer beater that took them.
Giannis, you know, is the best player in the league right now, obviously in the absence of LeBron James.
In the absence of Kevin Durant as well, obviously best player in the playoffs left, I think, and will win the season's MVP award. He has been the one dominant factor in that team. The Bucks won the Eastern Conference, and he has been the major factor in that. He is a physical beast. He's an unbelievable player. But I think the Bucks are looking pretty dominant in that series and are likely to go to Toronto, maybe win one of the two matches there, and they'll wrap it up at home, probably in five or six games maximum. Western Conference, on the other hand, is interesting for a number of reasons. Now, game three tomorrow is 5 a.m. UAE time in Portland. Trailblazers host the defending champions Golden State Warriors. Warriors lead the series 2-0. They are without Kevin Durant, who is the second best player globally in basketball behind LeBron James. I think that's undisputed. But they've gone to a retro style for the Golden State Warriors. It's the Splash Brothers who have to score all the points. It's Klay Thompson. It's Steph Curry. It's their old supporting cast. Andre Iguodala's carrying some slack. He's playing really well. Draymond Green stepping up as he does in the playoffs. and they are getting it done. They did have a massive comeback in game two. Portland should have closed that game out in game two, and it should be 1-1. But, you know, the players have stepped up in the absence of Kevin Durant. Now, interesting things are, can they get past Kevin Durant's injury? We don't quite sure how bad the calf injury is. He was supposed to come back by now. Steve Kerr's come out and said, it's worse than we thought it was. They're not giving a lot of direction on how bad the injury is. Obviously, they don't want to give anything away, but it's a fascinating time this season. What we should do is let's just start looking back at this game this morning, the Bucks taking on the Toronto Raptors. Let's listen quickly to the highlights, and then we'll break it all down.
It's the Toronto Raptors, the Milwaukee Bucks, game two of the best of seven, and the Bucks up one game to nothing.
Every night, you know, when the game starts, you know, my teammates are looking at me, and as a leader of the team, when the game starts, you gotta, like I said, it's all you gotta be focused.
Giannis, and it's back down on the funnel. Here's Gasol, left from behind.
And this crowd is absolutely rabid right now.
You know, he plays so hard. He just, you know, he lays it all on the line all the time. And, you know, just it was a great start for us. And I think everybody fed off of Giannis and how he started the game. You know, it's how you want to come into a game, too.
Beautiful whip pass by Bledsoe for the setup. Heritage goes in from downtown.
You got your coverages and your things you're going to do at the beginning, and we just missed them early, right? We were just a step too slow on just about everything, and gave them confidence early. You know that they're at home and they're going to come out with an extra, you know, pep in their step, and we just didn't do a good enough job of getting ourselves set up.
Middleton from way down is another three-pointer.
It's so nice seeing guys, you know, come into the game, being mentally prepared, setting the tone for the whole team, and we trust one another. In the beauty of basketball, this is the beauty of our team, that we trust one another. In this team, maybe any given night, guys can step up.
To come out and start game two with that kind of effort on both ends of the court, it's what you're looking for. You know, we just got to keep working, keep thinking about getting better.
Yeah, so another impressive performance from the number one seed Milwaukee Bucks, number one seed over in the Eastern Conference as well, and of course led by the Greek Freak and by the man who will, I agree with you, Archer, be the MVP for the season as well. He got 17 rebounds, 5 assists and 30 points in this game as well, but the Bucks head coach Mike Budenholzer said that it was about Giannis's effort that really fueled the Bucks' performance in that game 2 rout of the Raptors.
Brown is, you know, a great player, but when he left the East, you know, it's a great player going to the West. But, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. When the season started, I didn't know we were going to be in the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm not going to lie to you. I just know that he's a top.
All right, so that was actually Giannis there. And interesting from Giannis, from that bit of audio we just heard there, that's where he's talking about how he didn't really consider how open the East was after LeBron James left earlier in this season. He said basically at the beginning of the season they'll be quite even, but didn't realize there's an opportunity there for a team to go and dominate, and he feels now it can be him and his Milwaukee Bucks there. And I don't know about you, Arch, as well, but I just think obviously all the focus is going to be on Giannis, the Greek Freak, the MVP favorite, but for me the bench has been the big difference in these opening two games so far. We already know that the Milwaukee bench is one of the best in the league. They ranked third in points per game during the regular season. They were first in three-point attempts, second in assists as well. But they outscored the Raptors bench by 54 points to 39 the other day. So before the series started, I was talking to Robbie in the week saying, I can't wait to see Kawhi Leonard, who's a player I'm a massive fan of, up against the Greek Freak Giannis Antetokounmpo. But really, the difference for me is coming from the bench and the depth that the Bucks have.
Yeah, no, you did right. And everyone thought when LeBron went to the Lakers, the Boston Celtics were the team with the youngsters. They got Kyrie Irving there. They've got some really talented youngsters that seem to be the next dominant force in the East. Now, they had a terrible season. There's lots of dysfunctional things happening within that franchise at the moment. It'll be interesting to see what happens with them in the offseason. But the Greek Freak really stepped up there. And you say he's got the better supporting cast around him. He's got a bigger depth of bench and more guys who are stepping up to the plate. The team's being constructed around Giannis. And you look at Toronto, where Kawhi Leonard's basically rent a player. He's come in for a year. He's going to skip and probably go to the Clippers, or there's talk about he might go to the Knicks. Kyle Lowry has been hit and miss for them. You know, their key guy who can really dial it in from the distance and shoot the three ball. He had a good game in game one, and then he fell away in game two, and he's been inconsistent. But they just don't have the strength of depth to really... The Raptors seem to be a team that can go far in the playoffs but never quite get it done, and that's where they seem to be sort of capped. Again, Leonard's a phenomenal player. He's a top five player in the NBA, but he just can't do it all himself. 31 points. He led all scorers in game two. 31 points, but there's just not enough from the supporting cast. So strength of depth in the bench, the better score outside scoring in particular. And the Raptors don't have a presence. And Leonard is a shutdown defender. He is one of the elite defenders in the NBA. They don't have an answer for the Greek Freak.
And what about this Western Conference game as well? So Warriors down by 17 points during the first half there. I mean, I suppose the Portland Trailblazers are going to be kicking themselves now for not taking advantage of that as well. But fire back, Stephen Curry scoring 37 points. And then Draymond Green, the star of the game for me, 16 points, 10 rebounds, 7 assists, 5 blocks from him as well. This series is now pretty much all over, really, isn't it? Can you see any way back at all for the Portland Trailblazers?
No, I think the Trailblazers had to get it done in game two, and they failed to take the advantage there. Interesting matchup in here. It's the battle of the Curry brothers.
Yeah.
It's Seth versus Steph, and that's a tongue twister to go with that. But the parents are showing up because Del Curry, their father, was a famous NBA player as well, so there's a lot of good genes in the Curry family there. Seth Curry comes off the bench for the Trailblazers, and we know how good Steph Curry is, leading the way with the Golden State Warriors, really stepping into the form, because what they had to do with Kevin Durant there, they give him the ball in the big moments. They give him the opportunities because they know who is the go-to guy. Without him, the ball gets spread. They actually look like a better team without Kevin Durant.
Old school Warriors.
They've got to resort to a passing game. They obviously can still shoot the ball from the outside, but Iguodala and Draymond Green have to step up and take a much more physical role in that team. And they look really good. But one man we love hearing from, one man who always has an opinion or two, and he loves sharing it with the world, is our good friend from ESPN, Stephen A. Smith. Now, he reckons that Golden State Warriors can't win the final. They reckon he can't get past the Bucks without Kevin Durant. Let's just have a listen to our good friend, Stephen A. Smith.
It definitely is a wrap. I can't see Toronto winning more than one game this series. I actually said it was over after game one, because in that game, Kawhi Leonard had 31, Kyle Lowry had 30, Milwaukee shot just 25% from three-point range, 11 for 44, if I remember correctly,
yep,
and still won the damn game. So I figured, you know what, there's no way on earth, yeah, after a week of rust and them still finding a way to beat you, that they were going to lose game two. And sure enough, that's not what happened. They blitzed Toronto in the first half. It was over by then. So when you look at Milwaukee, they've got size. They play defense. They man up. They have perimeter shooting. Collectively, they're exceptionally well coached. They go after it, and they're starving, and they're led by the dominance of the Greek Freak. When you look at all of those things, I think there's only one thing that could potentially knock them off, and that is a healthy Golden State Warriors, because they can beat you from the perimeter all night long when KD is on the floor with Klay Thompson and Steph Curry, but he's not. And because he's not, Scott, I don't believe the Golden State Warriors that we saw last night in game two against Portland would beat the Milwaukee Bucks in the NBA Finals. They need KD. Otherwise, Milwaukee's going to win an NBA championship this year.
Well, I don't know whether we know this or not, but are they going to get KD for the NBA Finals? How is that injury progressing? And do you share, gentlemen, Stephen A. Smith's opinion that the Milwaukee Bucks will be favorite if it's a Warriors minus Kevin Durant?
No, they can't be favourites. I mean, the Warriors are going for the three-peat, two-time defending champions, going for a fourth title in 5 years. They have to be favourites, regardless of whether Kevin Durant is there or not, because they just have the better starting five. There's no doubt about that. I think you look, even without Kevin Durant, when you've got the Splash Brothers there, when you've got Andre Iguodala, when you've got Draymond Green, and I think what you'd be relying on for the Bucks is that the likes of Brook Lopez and Nikola Mirotic and Eric Bledsoe would turn up every single game. And Brook Lopez scored 29 points in their opening series game against the Toronto Raptors. didn't really fire on all cylinders in the earlier hours of this morning there. You can't afford to have that against the Warriors. So I think even without Kevin Durant, because, like, you know, like Art said before, the Warriors can just revert back to that kind of old school style they had of just moving the ball around. And even though it would be a lot closer, don't get me wrong, it would be a lot closer, I'd still have the Warriors a favourite, especially because I think they will put up a better fight. Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala will put up a much better fight against the Greek freak Giannis Antetokounmpo.
I'll rephrase that slightly, Mark Archer. If Kevin Durant does come back for the finals, if it is the Milwaukee Bucks indeed taking on the Golden State Warriors, do Milwaukee have any chance whatsoever?
Yeah, I think they have a chance. I think the Greek freak is that good. He's that difficult to match up to defend. He's that physical. He plays the inside game. He's a bit of a throwback, but he can shoot the ball as well. And without Kevin Durant, I tend to agree with Stephen A. Smith. Other factor is... the Bucks have home court advantage in the finals. They have the best record in the NBA. So they will play, of the seven-match series, they will play four matches at home. Game seven will be in Milwaukee. It's tough to get road wins in the finals. And take Kevin Durant out. He's a 30 to 40-point scorer every night. The depth of that team, the Bucks, does match up well. And if they can shut down Steph Curry, where's the scoring going to come from? Without Kevin Durant, without Steph Curry, where is the scoring come from? And Steph Curry has struggled in some big matches and big moments to really front up. He has struggled at times to really be the guy that's delivered, and that's the pressure on him to do that. So I think it's a tremendously even finals. I'd love it to see it with Kevin Durant not there. We wouldn't want to wish that on the Golden State Warriors, but it would be an amazing matchup to see. There's not little to divide the teams. Hope corner advantage to the Bucks, but they had the experience. They've been there and done it. With the Bucks, none of their players have been in the big final moment. They haven't witnessed that. Who knows how they're going to deal with the pressure? We don't know. The Golden State Warriors have been there, done that. They've got the rings. They've got the NBA championship, world championship trophy, and they'll be the team going into the final as the favourites.
And what's interesting as well is the last four meetings. So the two meetings they had this season, the two meetings they had in the previous year as well, in the regular season, of course, were all won by the away team. So maybe actually the home court advantage will flip on its head there, but that's certainly a factor to bring into mind. It'd certainly be, I think, a lot more competitive than we had in the last couple of years with the Cavs. We basically just had LeBron James and that was it, going up against the Warriors anyway. It'd be certainly more even, shall we say.
I want to talk a bit more basketball in just a few moments' time. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to The Grill at Barasti on Dubai Eye 103.8. The game is always on.
This is The Grill, live from Barasti. Enjoy your weekend with a 99 dirham main and a hot lunch combo.
We're talking sport on Dubai 103.8 all the way through until 6 o'clock. It's myself, Robbie Greenfield, it's Danny Norton, it's Mark Archer, and it's Monty. There's loads to discuss on The Grill. If you want to get in touch, 4001. We're building up to the Emirates FA Cup final. We're going to talk cricket in just a moment. I want to get your reaction as well, guys, to those Nick Kyrgios comments in the world of tennis from earlier this week. But just staying on basketball, we've been hearing about the conference finals between the Bucks and the Raptors. The Bucks dominating so far in the East, 2-0 up in that, and the Golden State Warriors 2-0 up against the Portland Trail Blazers in the Western Conference Finals. It doesn't very much seem like Warriors and Milwaukee Bucks will be the NBA Finals for 2019. Are we approaching the end of the Golden State Warriors era of dominance, Mark Archer? Will there be departures? Will there be high-profile departures from the Golden State Warriors team that will break up that core nucleus of great players? And could next season in the NBA look very different?
Yeah, I think from a Golden State Warriors perspective, there could be some big changes in the offseason. It's rumoured and highly talked about that Kevin Durant may leave. And the rumour is, why would
he do that?
Well, they're coming to a stage where people have said, the thing about him is he left Oklahoma City to win a championship. And people say he really cashed in his chips and went to a team that was the winners. He said they wanted his, from his perspective, can he go to a big club and they build a club around him? He went to a team with the Splash Brothers, with Draymond Green, with Boogie Cousins. He went to a celebrated outfit and made them stronger. Does he want any won a couple of rings? The thing about Kevin Durant is, does he want to go somewhere? Could he go to the Clippers? Could he go to the Lakers? Could he go to the New York Knicks, to a big market, and prove that he can win a championship with a team around him? He is the main guy. I'm not saying he's not the main guy.
Does he need to do that? Well, there's this obsession, there's this fascination in American sports, and I've noticed the likes of Stephen A. Smith always comment on this, that they belittle Kevin Durant for joining an already great team. surely he's earned the right to play for an already great team.
I think that's, I mean, it's a fact he's earned the right, but the way the sport works is, the problem with the Warriors this year is they have a couple of players coming into free agency, a couple of their high-name players, Klay Thompson in particular, and also Draymond Green. Kevin Durant is also a free agent, so you've got three players, and there's only so much money in your salary cap that you can pay players, so they can only afford, and those players think, or they reckon, but given their history in winning titles in the last few years, they want to get a max deal. They want 5 years, they want $150 million in their back. They want $35, $40 million a year, because that's what they can get in the market. The Golden State Warriors can't afford to keep them all, because they go massively into luxury tax. Now, Steph Curry has a maximum deal, but those players coming into their prime, they can't retain them all. Something has to give. So whether it's Klay Thompson, who's been there, I think, since he was drafted pretty much, do they go with keeping him and Kevin Durant? It won't work. Draymond Green will then, who is probably one player that sort of, it's the heart of that side. He does all the dirty work. He does the rebounding. He does puts a lot of blocks. He does that, you know, tough. Do they try and have to restructure and rejig it there and start again? Because it's a franchise that's been built over a number of years. They struggled for a long time, the Golden State Warriors, until they put some key pieces together almost a decade ago. So they're gonna have to lose something. But that's the great thing about American sport. There is always these sort of checks and balances to try and balance it out, so no team becomes dominant for too long. And then it depends on good coaching and good drafting and good internals. But yeah, let's wait and see. But I can't see this team they have now. DeMarcus Cousins as well, another player, he signed a one-year deal. He will move on because he wants that max deal if he can prove his fitness. So the Golden State Warriors next year will look markedly different from this year. Who goes, who stays? Well, let's just wait and see.
In terms of the Lakers, Danny, LeBron James would have not probably anticipated such a poor season for the Lakers. I'm sure, being realistic, he wasn't expecting to end up in the thick end of the playoffs maybe with that team. But they've also got a lot of work to do. And for LeBron as well, looking to further cement his legacy as maybe the greatest of all time, certainly one of the greatest of all time, it's an important couple of seasons for him.
Absolutely, I mean, but then at the same time, it was the good news for the Lakers that he did sign a long-term four-year contract with them, so they got the stability to know that they can plan ahead with him, which the Cleveland Cavaliers never had. It was always kind of pretty much year by year, and kind of could never really build for the long term. At least the Lakers can do that. They obviously wanted to get Anthony Davis from the New Orleans Pelicans in there during the trade deadline. Didn't pull that one off. Interesting that the New Orleans Pelicans won the lottery draft pick, the way it kind of works now. So even if you're the bottom side, you don't automatically get that number one pick. It goes into a lottery. I think it was a 9% chance they had of winning it. They pulled that one out there. So they're likely to go and get Zion Williamson from the college system, who looks an absolute beast of a player. But a lot of it will depend on what Anthony Davis does. It's going to be a fascinating summer when it comes to free agency. Arch mentioned before Kawhi Leonard, one of the top five players in the NBA. He's going to be a free agent. You got the likes of Kevin Durant. You got the likes of Klay Thompson coming up. You got the likes of Kyrie Irving from the Boston Celtics. There's a lot of players there. There's a lot of question marks. I think it's going to be one of the most interesting summers in the NBA in quite a few years. And you're absolutely right. We could be seeing a few different names around this stage next year. For me, for the Warriors, the key thing would be to keep Draymond Green. I think he is, even though he might not be the star player, for the dressing room, for the kind of competitive edge, he's their most competitive player. He had a falling out with Kevin Durant earlier this season as well, such is his competitive nature. I wonder if that one was really being kind of sorted out or just brushed under the carpet there. But for me, it'd be about keeping them. A story coming out earlier this week about Klay Thompson apparently not being too happy there. Steve Kerr, the Warriors coach, dismissed that there. But you do have to question that. Maybe he was kind of the number two guy to Steph Curry for so long, dropped down to become the number three guy after Kevin Durant arrived. Question marks about his role there. But if they do lose Kevin Durant to the New York Knicks, crucial for them to keep both Draymond Green and Klay Thompson, and maybe revert back, like we've seen in these last few games, to that kind of old school moving the ball around style.
It's going to be a fascinating summer in the NBA. It's going to be a fascinating last couple of weeks of this NBA season. The Milwaukee Bucks dominating over in the East. The Golden State Warriors doing likewise over in the West. They seem to be on a collision course for that NBA Finals. Will the Warriors need the return of their star man, Kevin Durant, in order to get past the Milwaukee Bucks? We will have to wait and see on that one. We've got an eye on the live tennis. It is the Italian Open over in Rome. Danny Norton was reporting on what has been a marathon match between Kiki Bertens and Joanna Konta. And it looks like Rafa Nadal and Stefanos Tsitsipas will be kept waiting.
It certainly does, because Joanna Konta is now just serving for this second set. She just broke Kiki Bertens a couple of games ago to go, in the last game, to level it, to go 6-5 up, in this second set. Kiki Bertens taking the opening set by 7-5 there. And this has been an absolute marathon of a semi-final match as well. Like we said before, pretty much every single game seeming to go all the way to deuce. Not much separating these two players in style, in intensity. Both of them giving it their very all on every single point here. And Joanna Konta serving 15 love up now as she looks to level matters at one set all in this semi-final of the Italian Open.
There we go. We will keep an eye on that. We'll keep you posted on that men's semi-final between Tsitsipas and Nadal as well. I want to talk Nick Kyrgios in just a few moments' time. I also want to talk a little bit of cricket. We're building up amazingly at the end of this month to the start of the ICC Cricket World Cup. Exciting times in the world of sport. We'll get Mark Archer's thoughts. We'll get Danny Norton's thoughts. We'll get Monty's thoughts on the Cricket World Cup. All that and more still to come.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Talking sport on The Grill for the duration of the afternoon, 3 until 6, as always, every Saturday. It's myself, Robbie Greenfield, it's Danny Norton, it's Mark Archer, and it's Monty. We're going to be touching on cricket in just a moment, building up to the summer spectacular that will be the ICC Cricket World Cup. But before we do that, we've been keeping tabs on the Italian Open in Rome, and it would be remiss not to discuss a certain Nick Kyrgios, who made the headlines for, yet again, all the wrong reasons a little earlier this week. Let me give you a little timeline of what Nick Kyrgios has been up to this week. He went on the No Challenges Remaining podcast. I think it was either Tuesday or Wednesday. I think it was Tuesday that he went on this podcast, and he discussed with journalist Ben Rothenberg some of the players, some of the big-name players in the world of tennis. He held nothing back. He gave his full unfettered opinions on all of these players, and we're going to hear about what he's had to say in just a few moments. Then he swiftly went on to throw an enormous tantrum on the court against Norwegian Casper Ruud. He was actually disqualified. He kicked a bottle, he threw down his racket, he hurled a chair on the court, he rowed with the spectators. He was fined €20,000 for unsportsmanlike conduct, and he also lost his prize money. He sent a grovelling message on social media to apologise for his actions. But let's hear where this story began. Nick Kyrgios talking on this podcast, holding nothing back, giving his views on the likes of Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer.
I'll go to Nadal next.
This is dangerous, but I don't know. He's my polar opposite. Yeah. Like, literally my polar opposite. And I don't like... And he's super salty. Like, every time I've beaten him, he always... When he wins, it's like... It's fine, you know, he won't say anything bad, like, he'll credit the opponent, like, he competed well today, he was a great player, but then as soon as I beat him, it's just, like, he has no respect for me, like, my fans, like, and I'm, like, and no respect to the game, and I'm, like, what are you talking about?
And that's when it's Djokovic.
I just feel like he has, like, a sick obsession wanting to be liked, like, he just wants to be, like, Roger, or, like, I feel like he, for me, personally, like, I don't care right now, like, I've come this far. I feel like he just wants to be liked so much that I just can't stand him. Like, this whole celebration thing that he does after his matches.
You're doing the boob throw thing.
It's, yeah, like, so cringeworthy. Okay. Like, it's very cringeworthy.
So, Novak Djokovic, according to Nick Kyrgios, is cringeworthy. Rafa Nadal is super salty and a very bad loser. What is your reaction, first and foremost, guys, to the fact that Nick Kyrgios, a professional tennis player who will be encountering these individuals in the locker room very soon? In the next couple of weeks, he'll have to bump heads with the likes of Djokovic and Nadal in the locker room. They will bump into each other. What is your reaction to the fact he went on this podcast and made these statements in the first place?
Well, it's refreshing to hear a bit of honesty, in a sense, certainly as a kind of from a journalistic perspective, even from a kind of a tennis fan perspective, as opposed to...
Isn't this what we love as journalists?
Yeah, it's the kind of controversy we like, but at the same time, you can't help but chuckle, can you, when he's talking about being cringeworthy and you look at his behaviour. I mean, what's more cringeworthy than that, really, when you look at the kind of strops that he throws, the kind of hissy fits that my toddler would be embarrassed about sometimes, you know what I mean? It's like, it's amazing, and he calls himself the polar opposite of Rafael Nadal. Well, when you look at the success that the two have had, he's absolutely spot on, really, isn't he? I mean, and it's a bit baffling, in a sense. You think, what do you really care about? What do you really want from life? And I don't think, and in all honesty, that's up to him as well. This isn't to kind of judge and say that he should want to win at all costs kind of thing, which I think the likes of Djokovic and Nadal and Federer do. He quite clearly isn't all that competitive. Yeah. He doesn't really care about winning majors, about kind of ending his career with as many trophies as he can do, in a sense. So maybe he's just a bit more kind of relaxed about kind of what he says. And you say about kind of he's going to see them in the dressing room in a few weeks. I don't think he himself cares at all. But it's, I mean, it doesn't really surprise me with him to a degree, but at the same time, you're looking at it and you think, well, it's all about cringeworthy. That, to me, is cringeworthy.
One of the things that Nick Kyrgios did say is that people take themselves far too seriously in the world of tennis, and I would imagine this would cross over to the wider world of sport as well. The fact that, you know, these individuals are behest to actually view their sport as life or death, the most important thing, you know, in that world, and it is for them. But at the end of the day, he just says, well, it's only hitting, it's whacking tennis balls over the net. He made the point about Fernando Verdasco thinking that he was, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread, and all he does is hit tennis balls over the net. Do top sportsmen and women take these top sports too seriously in this day and age, Mark Archer, or is Nick Kyrgios full of hot air yet again?
Well, what's nice about this, and I'm not going to condone his behaviour, and I've been pretty outspoken over a number of years about some of his behaviour and his lack of respect for the game of tennis, and his responsibilities as a professional athlete. I'm not saying he has to be a role model, but his behaviour has gone way beyond the line at some times. But he has spoken his mind. This is what he feels. And so that's quite refreshing to him to come out and say, I like this guy because of this. I hate this guy because of that. This guy's okay. He also says about Andy Murray, just to paraphrase, he says this is him, Nick Kyrgios, talking about Andy Murray. I feel like his record against Djokovic is embarrassing, I've told him. He says, you're so much better than Djokovic. You should have won so many more Grand Slams. So
I beg to differ.
Well, but that's as a player. So I mean, he has an opinion that can be voiced, and you can respect it, because he says, I play against them both, and he thinks Murray is a much better player to Djokovic. Despite the records, despite what they think, that's a player's opinion who has some talent, but a flawed personality. But, you know, he's Marmite, isn't he? To use an Australian phrase from Australia, he's Marmite. You love him or you hate him, but he just doesn't care. He just doesn't give a damn. And I think some of his play acting and his antics is almost showmanship. He almost throws the chair on the court to show off to a degree, to draw more attention to himself. And I just wish he would actually... He's one of those guys we've talked about. If he just focused on his tennis, he's so talented. He just hasn't got the discipline. He hasn't got the mental fortitude to probably knock it with those guys as much as he should. And you just wonder where his career... He's going to make a lot of money in his career. He's going to win a lot of ATP Tour events, you think. But is he really going to win slams? Is he tough enough? I don't know. Again, I think he's Marmite.
Monty, is the world of tennis a richer or poorer place with Nick Kyrgios in it?
I think it's a poorer place with Nick Kyrgios in it, because tennis, for me, draws audiences from various, you know, the royal families come to watch tennis. If you're watching tennis in Monte Carlo, you're watching Wimbledon. Tennis draws attention from good, you know, from good family background. People come and watch tennis. But Nick Kyrgios' behavior does not reflect on the future generation of kids who are going to be playing the sport. Tennis, for me, like cricket, is a gentleman's sport, and it's a family where players travel together on a circuit and get to know each other. There's a players' carnival at every event, etc. But Nick Kyrgios, for me, has crossed the line. What he showed the other day is definitely he deserves a ban for me, maybe suspension from the three Grand Slams.
Well, he said on Instagram, this was what passes for an apology from Nick Kyrgios. He says, eventful day, emotions got the better of me. I wanted to say that the atmosphere was crazy out there today. Just super unfortunate that it had to end in a default. Sorry, Roma. See you again, maybe. I mean, hardly a profuse apology, Danny.
No, through gritted teeth, no doubt as well. And you just got to look at his kind of his history as well, which has gone back down the years. But even just in recent months and in recent weeks as well, you know, this is a guy who basically kind of got clashed with a fan at the Miami Open back in March. Early this week, during his game against Daniil Medvedev, he served underarm, which is obviously kind of frowned upon in a sense, and is a very petty thing to do, I think, in tennis. And it's just been his behaviour for years and years, which we kind of know and we understand. And I suppose for us, it's the kind of disappointment knowing that he has the ability, he has the skill there But I know the kind of response that he said to that in the past is, well, I've got no responsibility, I've got no kind of requirement to go and try and put my all out all the time. I just need to turn up and kind of and do my thing, in a sense. But at the same time, when he's turning up and he's breaking the rules, I think punishment is required. But what I would say is I think the punishment he's had is punishment enough in itself. The only sad thing for me is I think it's just going to be a matter of weeks again before we're discussing him for this kind of thing instead of for a great victory over Novak Djokovic or Rafael Nadal.
Nick Kyrgios is no one's idea of a candidate to win the French Open at Roland Garros. Of course, it gets underway next week. It is the second tennis major of the year, and it's a bit of an interesting one, this, because Rafa Nadal, the man who's won 11 clay court titles in the men's game, obviously looks susceptible. Mark Archer, he looks vulnerable for the first time. He's been beaten by the likes of Stefanos Tsitsipas. He's not had the greatest clay court season. He's lost to Dominic Thiem as well. He's usually won a handful of clay court titles up until this point in the year, and it looks like Novak Djokovic, potentially having won in Madrid last weekend, having starting to hit top form at the right time, is perhaps, I say perhaps because you got to counter that with the fact that Rafa, it has been so dominant at Roland Garros. Who for you on the men's side is the favourite going into this tournament?
I think you've got to look at just where you've said at Djokovic and knowing what he does in the big occasion. You know, his game is very adaptable and clay is on the surface. You know, he can perform well on there. Unlike a Roger Federer, who hasn't played the clay court season in the last couple of years, he's been absentee from Roland Garros. It's tough to rule out Rafa Nadal. It's tough to write him off, Robbie. I'm not sure that's what you're doing, but it's tough not to think, given his track record, his phenomenal track record. I think he's lost twice in Roland Garros, hasn't he, in his career?
I believe so, yeah. 2015, he lost to Djokovic, I think, and then that was the year that Novak won.
He's lost to
Robin Söderling.
Yeah, so, I mean, how do you write a guy off that's and lost
one
twice?
Season, one season he was away with his injury.
Oh, so, that's right, yeah.
I mean, I love it. As relatively a neutral viewer of this, I would love one of the young guys to come through. I'd love Dominic Thiem versus Tsitsipas in the final to see a new winner, a new storyline, maybe a bit of a handing of the baton over from Nadal, but it's a brave man, Robbie. If you're writing him off, you're a braver man than me.
Novak going for the second successive time he's held all four Grand Slam titles in a row. That is something that Roger has never done. That is something that Rafa has never done. If Novak wins the French Open and Danny Norton holds all four Grand Slam titles, not once, but twice, does that eclipse anything that Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal have done in the game of tennis?
I don't think it eclipses anything that they've done in a sense. It just adds more credence to the argument. I think, actually, Robbie, correct me if I'm wrong here, but both you and I have made where we've discussed it on the shows in the past before, saying that we think on this day Novak Djokovic is the best of all time.
I agree.
And yeah, he has the best all-round game, in a sense. And I think it's just only me and you, really. I know we get like a lot of pushback against that idea.
Well, Chris McCarty is an avid Roger Federer fan, so
is,
that would
course,
explain
yeah,
his particular position on this.
Yes, but I mean, looking ahead to the French Open, I don't think you can have anyone but Rafael Nadal as favourite, in spite of anything that might happen later on this afternoon when he eventually takes on Tsitsipas in the semi-final of the Italian Open, just because of his record there at Roland Garros. I think he's the kind, and his game on clay, even though he might be a little bit out of form for his standards, he can still just step it up whenever required, and has the game to defeat Novak Djokovic. Novak Djokovic should obviously be the clear second favourite, but I think when you look beyond them, maybe Dominic Thiem, he was the losing finalist there last year. He's been in good form again this year, like Arch said before, defeating Nadal on the red surface just a few weeks ago there. So it's going to be a fascinating couple of weeks at Roland Garros. I really can't wait for it. If Djokovic completes it though and wins yet another slam, it's just a step towards him being talked about as potentially the greatest player ever.
Listen, Serena Williams, she pulled out of the Italian Open with that knee injury. We will focus just very briefly on the women's side of the draw for the French Open. And it's a tough one to really ascertain this, because Naomi Osaka has been the superstar when it comes to Grand Slam tournaments. There's no doubt about that. The US Open last September, the Australian Open just a couple of months ago back in Melbourne, Danny Norton. Simona Halep right on her heels in the WTA ranking. The likes of Angelique Kerber, proven performer on the Grand Slam stage. Kiki Bertens, who we're watching, taking on Joanna Konta in the semi-finals of the Italian Open. Also a player on good form, currently ranked world number 4. And Serena just doesn't really play in tournaments other than Grand Slams, other than in majors now. So it's getting increasingly hard to make a case for Serena Williams being able to, first of all, circumnavigate injury, and then second of all, string 7 great matches together, because the standard is so unrelenting in the women's game.
Yeah, I'd have to put Simona Halep as the favourite going into this. Obviously, she is the defending champion there. She's been in good form the last few weeks as well. A couple of surprising defeats along the way, but still, she got to the final of the Madrid Open last weekend. She got to the semi-final of the Miami Open. Didn't do as well as she would have liked to at Indian Wells, going out in the last 16 there, but she is the world number 2, like you say, and I think just her game of kind of her counter attacking game in a sense is kind of well suited to it. She's got the experience of winning there, and just with the injury problems that Naomi Osaka and Serena Williams are having over the last few weeks, I think just makes Halep just the slight favourite going into it. But again, as always with the women's game, you just never really know what's going to happen, and there's never really a clear favourite.
Yeah, absorbing stuff. The French Open, Roland Garros, one of my favourite events of the year. It gets underway next week. I wonder, will it be number 12 for Rafa Nadal? Will Novak win 4 in a row? Will Serena do the unthinkable and get the Grand Slam record as well? We wait and see on that one. We'll talk a little cricket up next. You're listening to The Grill.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Certainly is, and we're going to turn our attention to cricket. A lot going on in the world of cricket. Before we look forward, I think only right that we look back, Mark Archer, because it's been an eventful couple of weeks over in yet another frenetic instalment of the IPL.
Yeah, IPL is done and dusted, and congratulations to the Mumbai Indians. They defeated the Chennai Super Kings, their fourth title in 7 years. All eyes now formally focus on the ICC Cricket World Cup. Gets underway May the 30th at the Oval in South London, where England, the hosts, will take on South Africa. That should be a cracking match to get a festival of cricket underway. But congratulations to Mumbai. They've just done a wonderful job with their backroom staff and their leading Indian players there. They've been very consistent over recent years, and they've been there or thereabouts. But let's just break it down. Let's listen to our good friends at Cricket Info, ESPN, tell us about what made the Mumbai Indians so special when they won the title, their fourth title in 7 years. This is their summary of the Mumbai Indians.
The IPL is a tournament designed to ensure a level playing field. There is a cap on how much each team can spend on players, so franchises can't win titles simply by splurging. And every 3 years, you have to reshuffle, so franchises cannot simply keep together a winning 11. Despite this, in the past 7 years, one team has emerged as a clear dominant force in the IPL. Mumbai Indians have won 4 of the past 7 titles, all under Rohit Sharma. So just how have they done it? Let's start by looking at the squads that won their last 2 titles. They were built around 4 Indian players: Rohit Sharma, Jasprit Bumrah, and the 2 Pandya brothers. These are currently Mumbai's most expensive players, and they've spent a total of 41.80 crores on them. This is more than any other team has spent on their 4 most expensive buys, but not by a huge margin. What stands out is, first, Mumbai are one of the only 2 teams to have 4 Indians as their highest paid players, the other being CSK. Since you need 7 Indians in an IPL 11, and overseas players are often not available for the whole season, having a strong contingent of home players is a massive advantage. But even more importantly, 3 of these 4 players fill spots that are usually hard to fill with Indians: elite fast bowler and genuine all-rounders. Look at all-rounder stats since 2015. Of the 10 all-rounders who've taken over 25 wickets and scored over 500 runs, just 4 are Indians: the Pandya brothers, Ravindra Jadeja and Akshar Patel. When you look at the average differential, which is batting average minus bowling average, Krunal's is just minus 1.99, while Hardik's is minus 2.39. The other 2, on the other hand, have differentials of minus 8.57 and minus 11.53 respectively. If you're confused by those numbers, what we're saying essentially is that the Pandya brothers are by far the best Indian all-rounders in the IPL. And this makes them among the most valuable players, because it's great to have a top overseas batsman or an excellent Indian spinner, but there are just more of those types of players around. So if you miss out on the 12.5 crore worth David Warner, you can get a Josh Butler for 4.4 crores and still have a strong overseas player. Miss out on Yuzvendra Chahal worth 6 crores and you can get Shreyas Gopal at 20 lakhs. Don't have the 11 crore worth Suresh Raina, get a Shikhar Dhawan for 5.2. But the drop-off from the Pandya brothers to the next best set of Indian all-rounders is massive. And other teams are often left fielding bits and pieces players, sometimes even wasting an overseas spot on them. It is a similar case with Jasprit Bumrah. Forget Indian fast bowlers. Over the past three seasons, Bumrah has been the top fast bowler, period. His economy rate, 6.97. That's a whole half a run better than the next best, Bhuvneshwar Kumar. Apart from Deepak Chahar, every other Indian quick has an economy rate of over 8. So to think that Bumrah currently costs Mumbai just 7 crores out of their purse, less expensive than quicks such as Jaydev Unadkar, Chris Wokes and Mitchell Stark, who hasn't even played for the past two seasons, that explains a lot about why Mumbai have been so successful. So now the question is, how did Mumbai end up with this awesome core group to build a squad around? And for that, we need to go into a little bit of IPL history. In 2010, Mumbai lost their first IPL final and the owners of the team decided to set up a system that would allow the management and coaching staff to work through the year rather than just during the IPL. They put together a scouting team which had among its members former India coach John Wright and former Indian cricketers Kiran More, Abhi Kuruvilla and T.S. Sekar. They began to look for players from all over India, watching even club matches. And they focused on looking for players who are unorthodox. That is how they found Jasprit Bumrah. John Wright saw him bowling in a Syed Mushtaq Ali Trophy game back in 2013 and saw one ball hit a footmark and fly over the keeper, which convinced him that Bumrah had special pace. Similarly, More found the Pandya brothers when they enrolled in his academy. Bumrah was bought for 1.2 crore in 2014 and the Pandya brothers for just 10 lakh each over the next two seasons. This scouting system has also seen young players such as Mayank Markande and Rahul Chahar come to Mumbai. And before that, Jagdish Suchit and Abu Nechim all had great bargains. The other important part of the 365-day plan is that Mumbai Indians have their own playing facility in Navi Mumbai, where players train even in the off-season. The facility will even manage players' recoveries from injuries. All this means Mumbai don't just spot young talent, but also develop it. So, okay, we know how Mumbai Indians have put together the strongest squad, but in T20 cricket, it takes more than that to win games. That's where Mumbai's stats-based strategic philosophy comes in.
While I was working in my previous company at the back end for Mumbai Indians, the kind of data requests that come were all very deep and very strategic in nature. The relationship between the captain and the analyst is also very important. And that worked very well in favor of Mumbai Indians because they do have meetings where they kind of go through a lot of matchups, kind of go through venue stats, who's weak in what, and then make decisions.
The Mumbai think tank used deep statistics to pick specific bowler-batsman matchups. For example, this season, they knew Virat Kohli averages less against left-arm pace than other types of bowlers. So they played Jason Berendorf against RCB and he got the captain of RCB out. Against Andre Russell, they figured their own way to get him out, which was for a right-arm quick to go around the wicket and pitch it in short. So they asked Lasith Malinga to do that and again, the plan worked. Also part of Mumbai's philosophy is being ruthless when it comes to letting players go and dropping them from the 11. Take the example of their middle-order Indian batsmen. In 2012 and 2013, they had Dinesh Karthik doing a pretty good job for them there. But in the 2014 auction, they found that Karthik had become too expensive. He went for 12.5 crores, so they did not chase him. Instead, they shifted Ambati Raidu up the order for a couple of years, while they groomed a young player in Nitish Rana. He had a promising 2017 season for them, but in the next season, Mumbai found that Ishan Kishan, another highly regarded young player who had the ability to keep wickets as well, was available. So they let Rana go and brought Kishan in. Even Josh Butler, a cult hero of sorts in Mumbai, was allowed to go to Rajasthan Royals since another dynamic opener in Evan Lewis was available at a lower price. And he was also likely to be available for more games. When it comes to leaving players out of the 11 too, Mumbai have left big names such as Lasith Malinga, Yuvraj Singh and Harbhajan Singh out when they felt that there were better alternatives for specific games. But Mumbai understand the importance of sticking by loyal players too. Rohit, Malinga and Kyron Pollard have all been in the squad for 9 years or more, and they have been able to guide younger players. Now, not all of Mumbai's moves work, and they've even had some poor seasons, missing the playoffs in both 2016 and 2018. But when you have a team of coaches, scouts, physios and analysts working round the year, chances are you are going to make the best use of the 82 crore purse among all teams. And few can argue that Mumbai over the years have done just that.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.